Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Busy week this week. I feel like it's our first busy week in a while.
Yeah, there was stuff going on.
Yeah, for we had the late December and early January kind of smooth sailing, and then all of a sudden, I don't know about you, I had a lot going on. There was Apple results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was an executive change announcement.
Right.
Tim Cook gave a speech about privacy, data privacy, and
there were some point releases, updates,
and the report card finally came out. So, right. You know, busy week as it turns
busy
out.
Busy week.
I couldn't put off doing the report card any longer, so it's out now.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I mean, it's a lot of work. I understand. I read it all this morning.
There's a lot of
there's a lot in there.
A lot of search and replace manage all of those. Everything I wrote in that piece about the Family Feud compiling goes for the report card too. I have all these columns of data because everything comes in a spreadsheet, and I have to do this thing where I massage it. And you know, the people who really got me this time, I'm going to single them out by name now, are Casey Liss and Christina Warren. Because they wrote multi-paragraph responses to every single one. Now, I started inserting, for Christina's benefit, in the email. I don't mind her writing it. I mean, I mind because it messes up some of my compilation stuff, but I don't mind her writing a lot. I feel bad that she writes so much, and then I don't use all of it because, I need to cut it down. I want it to be kind of to the point. But I will say that so I warned them in email now. I'm like, I may not use your whole response. You don't need to write a lot. Casey and Christina still wrote a lot of multi-paragraph responses, which is fine, except when I'm trying to get everything out as tabular data, basically, and then organize it in a way where I can sort of search and replace, so I can say, Casey List said, comma, quote, right? A multi-line response is not great. And then the other... I need to approach this from a more systematic perspective and like map it all out beforehand next year if I remember. The problem is you wait a year and then I forget everything and I have to invent it again. Right. A year is too long. But what I did this year, because I've been dissatisfied in the past because I either sort the responses by their name or they're sorted just in the version they came in, and every flow is the same. From every topic, it's sort of like the same people. I rejigger it a little bit, but it's mostly in the same order. And so this year I decided I was going to randomize every single response block. But to do that, I really need to have everything on one line. So I had to do some manual stuff and all that. But in the end, it came out. It's just a lot of text processing. And then I have to, after the text processing and the spreadsheet and the chart making and all that, I do have to go through and read the responses. And I try to... My added value there, beyond just bringing all these people together, is to slim down some of the responses and remove some responses that are very much like the other responses that you've already seen, and try to make it, even though it's still kind of a lot to read, it's less than half of what got submitted. So it's just a whole process.
I mean, yeah, I cut back on what I wrote the last couple of years because...
Thank you. It doesn't go anywhere.
Right. It doesn't. I mean, yeah, it's more work. It's more work for me, frankly. But on the other end of the spectrum, it's also because sometimes at the end of the year, I definitely struggle with trying to remember what the hell happened.
Yeah.
In the last year.
In the iPad category, a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, Magic Keyboard. Remember that?
Right.
It's like, yeah, exactly. that was in 2020. Yes, it was. It was in 2020. Funny things that happened in this one is, got the highest score we've ever gotten in 6 years of it, which was the Mac. And we got the lowest score we've ever gotten in 6 years, which was Apple TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got all the ends of the spectrum there. I mean, pointing to that fact, which I think Casey said in one of his other comments about Apple having trouble, you know, walking and chewing gum at the same time, which is to say... It's a huge company, and there's lots of different areas that they're focused on, but it does sometimes feel like the spotlight, if you will, jumps from place to place. And it's not to say they're not working on those things behind the scenes, right? But like, it's been a long time since an Apple TV update, and that's the biggest amount of frustration, I think, as you said, to people, is not that, you know, I have an Apple TV. I use it every day. It is totally fine. But as a product, if you were going into that market right now saying, I want to buy a set-top box... there are a lot of reasons not to pick an Apple TV.
By Roku.
And that's a bad situation to be in for Apple, right? Is a place where it's like, your device is fine, but it's not competitive.
I mean, honestly, the Roku boxes have AirPlay and Apple TV app support. So
right.
Exactly.
There's not as much. It used to be that the Apple TV did have some differentiators in that department, and certainly access to the App Store is still attractive in some cases, but most of what people use the Apple TV for is the stuff that's available on every other platform, right? It tends to be video stuff, not the apps or the games even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that it's not surprising. And you know, I can make the argument, and I think when we try, there's the trying to understand Apple part of my brain, and then there's the what Apple should do part of my brain, and they're different, right? So trying to understand Apple is, you got to look at them and say, Apple is not structured in a way that they can turn over their entire product line in every category every year, right? They can't do it. They can't do it the way that they're structured. They can't. And so what you see is what you said, which is it's like the eye of Sauron, right? It's like there is focus in parts of the company, but other parts of the company feel like they have been completely ignored. And some of that is Apple's secrecy, where they aren't going to tell you until you, if they're doing a big lift that's going to take 3 years, they don't tell you.
Yeah, exactly. They spend years on these things, and they are not a company to talk about it when school is out, basically. With the very rare exceptions, right? I think of that pro Mac roundtable.
Yeah, that's the exception that proves the rule, right?
Exactly. It happens once in a blue moon.
So sometimes it's that, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just a lack of attention, and they move people. We've heard the stories. They move people to projects that are more high priority, and so those other products just kind of sit there. There's one person to maintain them, and it basically isn't. It's just bug fixes and whatever. So that's true. The other part of my brain, though, would say, Apple is one of the most valuable companies in the world, and just had a quarter where they made more than $100 billion in revenue, and their profit was like 20-some billion dollars.
Right.
And so what I would say, if I'm trying to sort of diagnose Apple, rather than just understanding how they're structured, what I would say is, you got to be better. And I know that it's like, oh, but they're so successful and they make a lot of money. I get it. But, and this has been true since the Steve Jobs era, so this is not a new story, but their ambition outstrips their ability. It does. They're a very ambitious company. Their ambition is enormous. And they have proven their ability to prioritize the most important products. But, I mean, remember iBooks was one of the ones that I always talked about, iBooks author and the bookstore and all of that. It's like, Apple's got a lot of things where they're like, no, we're going to play here. Aperture was a good example, right? And then they're like, not willing to put in the effort to actually play there. And so Apple's presence leaves a kind of a black hole, because it's like, oh, well, Apple's there. Nobody wants to compete with Apple. And who knows when they're going to wake up and do this thing. But, you know, they could solve this. This is the two parts of the brain is, I get why it's that way, but they've got a lot of resources. People want to work at Apple. They've got a lot of projects. If you're going to do a project, you got to do it right. And I think that mystifies me, that a company that is on some level so committed to delighting its customers and providing value and all of that seems to be unable to properly maintain and push forward the products it's chosen to do. And I would almost argue, I am arguing that if you can't commit to a certain level of update and improvement, you shouldn't make that product. You should just shut it down. Shut down the Apple TV or update it every year or two, right?
Here's the thing, though, which is funny about that. There are cases where they have done this, right? I mean, displays, the airport, right? Like cases where they're like, we're getting out of this market. We don't do that much work in this market. It's not a huge market for us. And yet, what's funny about that is then you have displays, which is a market where it's like, come back around. It's like, well, maybe we'll make like a really expensive display.
I mean, I would argue that the Wi-Fi market has had multiple solution, you know, put out that by various vendors that do the kind of like provide a solution to the problems that people have. Whereas displays,
Apple
as a Mac user,
in that way,
right? But as a Mac user trying to buy a good display that is at a, you know, a 27-inch 5K display, let's say, you basically can't. There are very few options out there. There are a lot of 4K displays that are huge that are going to be not nearly the resolution that you'd expect from something out of an iMac. That's a case where the market has failed Apple, and the Apple kind of has to step in, whereas in Wi-Fi, yeah, they don't. But like, my broader point is just, and this goes to software, it goes to iWork, it goes to tvOS, it goes to, you know, you name it. Like, if you're going to do it, do it up to Apple's level of quality. And I think when the Apple TV gets a failing grade, and maybe there are extenuating circumstances, but like, that's a product that basically hasn't changed, other than like little minor things around the edges, in years, and costs so much more than the competition without providing a real premium experience. Why is it there? Why does it exist? Why do that product if you're Apple? It's embarrassing.
I find the Apple TV a puzzling and at times just incredibly amusing product. And
like you, I use it every day. That is my prime, other than the TiVo for things that we recorded off of cable. Everything else we watch is on the Apple TV. Everything.
My favorite exemplar of it being a weird product is still the fact that it has storage tiers. Like,
yeah,
for no discernible reason.
Nope.
And I have done like the poking around on this, and it's like, you can't really fill an Apple TV. That's not actually a thing that you can do. Even the smaller size, like the amount of stuff you would have to download in order to do that, it's a fair amount. Most people are not even gonna get close to it, and yet they still sell it as like an upsell, right? Oh, you should get the 64 gig one in case you play a lot of games. Nobody plays that many games on the Apple TV. Nobody. I find that befuddling. And it's like, you know, we're talking about a $200 box now, which, again, yeah, like you said, it's incredibly overpriced for where it is. And I think that's where all that frustration is coming out in the report card. It's like, Apple has it within them to make a good set-top box. And again, I would argue the Apple TV is a good set-top box, but I think it's overpowered and over-designed for what most people use it for. And I think that's the thing they struggle with, right? Because Apple doesn't want to compete in the $50 streaming stick market because there's not a lot of margin in that. And instead, it's at the other end of the spectrum where it's like, you know, this thing's really expensive, but it's also the really expensive thing that's no longer top of the line. So there's a whole bunch. I mean, like, you could just cut the price. I feel like that would make a whole bunch of difference.
It's that old. Why not cut the, right? Yeah, like, I mean, just do the thing where you cut the price $50 or $100
If it were $99, like, I feel like it would be a much more, which is where it started, by the way. I mean, the Apple TV, when it came out in that form factor, the little black puck, it was $99. And people are like, that's expensive-ish, but it's not bad for what you got, you know?
Because I'm not saying, right, exactly. I'm not saying Apple needs to price even with Roku, because Apple doesn't do that.
They can't win that game.
And I think Apple will, because it's an Apple product, and I do think it has some benefits over those other products, just not at the price.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely overpriced for what it is. And that's, you know, it could also use, I think the improvement on it is much more a software thing than a hardware thing. I think the hardware is fine. Again, at a cheaper price, it would be fine. There's not that much hardware you need in one of these things. Again, like, it's over. We talked about the remote stuff recently too, and like, it's overpriced. It's over-engineered. You could get by with a product that is a little more modest, and it would do a lot better.
Yeah, it's engineered for games. It's engineered for Apple Arcade, essentially.
It's not particularly
great
at that either.
And if they want to make something that is a newer chip, better, you know, maybe comes with a game controller or whatever, and say, this is Apple TV game, Apple TV +++, and then also sell one that is not and is cheap. That makes sense to me, actually, but not what they have now. Yeah. Meanwhile, the Mac got an A, almost an A+, very close to an A+. I didn't have A+ in my scale, but then I realized what it would be, and it was like a tenth of a point short of almost an A+. And it's funny because a lot of the people's comments about the Mac were obviously about Apple Silicon and the M1 and all of that. There was also a lot of relief about the butterfly keyboard being gone. And that was also in the hardware reliability section. But what really struck me is that a lot of people are like, yeah, I don't like the stuff in Big Sur, although it's better than Catalina. I got issues, but it doesn't matter because of Apple Silicon. And I thought that was really funny that, like, I'll give it a pass. Like, people are like, normally I wouldn't give this 5 out of 5 because of Big Sur. I don't know. But Apple Silicon, so 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
Like, all right.
Big Sur, it struck me reading through how divisive Big Sur remains. And I think which is interesting because Catalina, it's a one up on Catalina in that Catalina seemed to have very little positive feedback from it, right? Like, there are a lot of people like, oh, I had to upgrade to Catalina and it's fine. Big Sur at least feels like, well, there's some people who really like some of the stuff that's been changed in there. And there are definitely a few spots in Big Sur that are not great. But at the same time, it seems like the experience was not as bad as some expected. But some people really hate it. It's really polarizing. Yep. I was struck by that. And I thought about it because I've been, you know, as I was mentioning in a Slack conversation with you and some other folks this week, I've had some problems on my iMac still running on Catalina. I was like, maybe it's finally time to jump to Big Sur. And I have my M1, obviously, is already running Big Sur because that's what came with it.
Yep.
And I just, yeah, I had that moment of like, I think it would be fine. It's just a moment of thinking like, I'm surprised that there are all these places that they still haven't quite ironed things out that feel kind of rough around the edges. And is this a situation where we have to wait for macOS? My God, what is it going to, what are the, is it going to be 11.1?
No, we already 11, have that. Right. It'll be macOS 12.
What? It's going to be, okay. Woo.
Unless it's 11.5.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must be 12, I guess. Yes, now that we've finally incremented
that number.
I'm running
11.1 right now, Dan.
Yeah, I was like, that's not right. That's not the right number. I realized that. Because 11.2 is in release candidate
I thought
and probably
you were,
comes out next week or
I
something.
I thought you were picking a California place name. So, King's Canyon.
Yes, what have you. But it strikes me as odd that there are all these things. Like, I know Lex Friedman, who has complained both in the report card and elsewhere to me, that he hates some of the changes to the notifications in Big Sur,
quote I didn't use but I probably should have is where he said Big Sur makes me big surly.
That's very Lex.
Lex.
And you know, I know a lot of people who have been frustrated about some of the workarounds because of the security stuff. You know Rogue Amoeba has obviously had to do a lot of engineering to get their stuff to work right, and you know, I will agree with a lot of people that a lot of the UI changes are sloppy. They're just sloppy.
I like a lot of the things they're trying, but they got a lot of stuff to fix. And look, one of the things that made me laugh out loud is if you look at the software quality chart, at the top of every section, I've made these little things that show you the progression of that category over time, which is one of the nice things when you do it for 6 years, you build up. I learned this from IDG, where we did the employee survey every year. And some of the questions they asked were ridiculous. And we'd say,
increasingly irrelevant.
Can't you reword this? And the answer was, well, no, because we've asked the same question for 25 years and we need the historical archive. And I would be like, well, do you? But then again, I'm doing that where I'm asking an Apple Watch question and a wearables question because I want to redefine that. But I don't want to give up the historical. Anyway, what I'm saying is you get these little lines of how sentiment has changed over 6 years. And this is obviously this whole survey is just a measurement of gross sentiment of people who pay attention to Apple, which I think can be informative. But it is, you know, people disagree and stuff. But it's like, where's the tide taking you? And software quality is hilarious because if you ever wanted proof that Apple is on a TikTok cycle where there is a disruptive release that breaks everything and makes everybody miserable, and then a year where Apple's like, oh boy, we got to fix this and we got to fix that, you will see it there. Because that the needle is just like up, down, up, down, up.
It really does ping pong.
This year was an up year, by the way, because again, even though Big Sur had a lot of these visual issues and there are issues with Big Sur, iOS 14 and Big Sur were not nearly as disruptive as Catalina and iOS 13 were.
Yep,
so,
agreed.
Talk is what I'm saying.
I'm strongly considering updating to Big Sur. The one thing that just held me back right now today as I was thinking, like, oh, maybe that'll be my project for this afternoon, was noticing that Super Duper, I think, is still not compatible.
No, you can use Carbon Copy Cloner, and that works, and I'm using that, but Super Duper is still not working right, which I feel really bad for Dave, but you know, Rogue Amoeba could be there too, but they've managed to fight it off. But Super Duper's still not there. Yeah, I've been using Carbon Copy Cloner, in fact, on my iMac since I got up and running with a final version of Big Sur. I'm now backing up every day using Carbon Copy Cloner instead. Those apps are both great. Like, I don't want to pick a winner. Yeah. I will use one for a while, and then I'll use another. My server is actually still using Super Duper because it's on Mojave. Mostly because I kind of like want to have a refuge where 32-bit apps can run just in case, although I haven't done it. It's like, I feel like maybe for software compatibility reasons, keeping a 32-bit app capable OS around would be a good idea. But I like both those apps. They're both really great. The people who work on them are great. And so, you know, take your pick. But right now, yeah, CCC
I end up with my
Slate
super duper bonus just because Dave's a good friend of mine. Yeah. But I use Carbon Copy Cloner before as well, and it's also an excellent tool.
Mike Bombich has also been writing Mac software for
forever.
Decades,
I remember. Yes.
So yeah, like he's in. They're all in that same camp with Rich Siegel and James Thompson as people who've been writing software for a very, very, very long time. So here's a funny thing. So on the day of the results, I was going to write something in the morning. I thought I want to write up a little like a tippy thing about an app. And there was an app that somebody on Twitter referred me to because I was complaining about how HomeKit doesn't work on the Mac very well. You can use the Home app, but like it's not scriptable or anything. And then I tried to script it with Keyboard Maestro. I was going to write a piece, which I may still write, that's a version of something I've already written, but every time I mention it, people can't believe it, which is like Keyboard Maestro. You can literally take a screenshot of a thing you want the mouse to click on as part of a script in Keyboard Maestro, as part of a macro, and say, okay, do you see this on the screen? Click there, which is bananas, but it works most of the time. However, guess what? That didn't even work in the Home app. Like, the Home app is so bad and so broken. And I found, like, pulling down certain menu items just completely break the Home app until it relaunches. It's very bad. So, yay, Catalyst. But anyway, there was an app I found that did HomeKit and put it in the menu bar. And I thought, oh, well, this is great. I'm going to tell people about that. And you could keyboard shortcut and everything. But the problem that it had was that it was only going to work with, what are they called? Scenes. It only worked with scenes.
Oh,
it was
right,
called,
right. Yeah.
It's an app called Scene Cuts. And it's very clever, sits in your menu bar, but it only triggers HomeKit scenes. And I thought, well, I don't want to make a scene. I don't want to make a scene, everybody. But I just want to like turn on the lamp on, you know, or turn on the lights against my window. My lighting in my office, I've got a floor lamp that's on a smart switch. Or no, it used to be. Now it's just a Hue bulb. And then I've got these Hue strip lights around my window that throw light on the wall. It's very nice, especially on a cloudy winter day. It's really nice. So that morning I get out, I'm like, what am I going to write about? Am I going to write about this thing? I said, I should look in the App Store for all the HomeKit apps that are on the Mac App Store. And the answer is there's a handful. There's not that many. But that morning I find Home Control Menu, and I'm like, oh my God, this is exactly what I wanted. Well, okay, and it's like it lets you choose what displays in the menu bar. It can do scenes. It can do individual items. You can bind keyboard shortcuts to turn those items on and off. And I was like, all right, well, that's pretty good. It could, and I'm thinking like, I'm going to write this up, but I want to give some constructive criticism. I'm like, this is a little weird and you can't hide. Like, it shows you the home it's in case you've got multiple homes. And I was like, can I just turn that off? Because I never want to see that column and I want to sort by what room it's in. And it doesn't, there's all sorts of stuff it doesn't do. And I think automation, right? AppleScript and all that. And I look, and it supports automation, which I was like, what are you doing? It supports X callback URL, which is iOS automation, which is kind of hilarious. But it has some nice things where if you like right click on an item, it will let you copy the X callback URL to the clipboard. And if you want to do something using AppleScript, you can literally just tell it to open location with the X callback URL and it'll do it. So basically, you can automate this is part of a script or using Keyboard Maestro or whatever you want, or you can just use the basic key bindings that are in the app. And I was like, this is great. So I started thinking I would write probably about this one app, and I ended up writing about a completely different app that I found that was way better. And I love it because honestly, the use case here is I sit down at my desk and I think, yeah, it's kind of dark. I want those strip lights on. And now I can just go boop and they're on. It's great.
Yeah. I've wanted that for you. That's the thing. I thought about this a bunch, and it kind of occurred to me that this is a place where Apple, a little bit like what we talked about before, where Apple lets products kind of abandon, you know, or just sort of like stops working on things or doesn't do it to its utmost. If HomeKit / Home app had been a Mac first thing, this is how it would have worked. But because it ended up being something that was ported from iOS, and they're like, well, we've got Mac Catalyst. Like, let's just use that to bring the Home app, which is perfectly functional on iOS, to the Mac, right? And it's like, yes, but what you ended up with is a very iOS-like experience on the Mac, whereas if you had designed this from the ground up for the Mac, you would have something that feels a lot more like a menu bar item where you can control things, because that makes more sense on the Mac.
Yeah, exactly. The Home app... Well, and the Home app interactions are really bad. Like,
but beyond that, it's just it doesn't want to... It's not a thing that you have focus on, right? It's not a thing where it's like, I want this app because I am thinking about, like, right. I'm going to work in the Home app. No, you're not going to work in the Home app. I want to turn a light on.
Most of my Home app interaction, most of my HomeKit interaction on iOS is through Control Center.
Control Center, yep, 100%.
Now, which I love. It's so good. The other problem is, and you see this, like, you're right. On the Mac, you should completely reconceive this. It should be a menu bar item that's available out of Control Center, and it's probably on their to-do list, right? Now that they've got Control Center, I would be shocked if they didn't put favorites of HomeKit in Control Center and also let you kind of launch things from Control. But the favorites would do it, right? If they mirrored what they did on iOS, on macOS Control Center, they could solve this.
Because it's an ancillary function.
Right. But the other thing is... Mac apps, you got a cursor, you know, a pointer, and you click, right? And like on iOS, a lot of the gestures are tap to hold and then adjust the brightness or the color or whatever. And on the Home app, like on the Mac, you're like, well, I'll click on this thing. It's like, oh, off. Like, no, that's not what I want. But you can't click and hold and have it do a thing. And so you have to write, like, when I want to adjust things on the Mac, I have to like right click on the thing and then choose. Yeah. Settings or whatever, and then it opens, and then I can adjust it, and then I have to close that window. It's so bad, and you'd never build that way on the Mac. And so then I see something like this app, and I think, yeah, that's it. Like they did it, and honestly, those are the utilities I like the most, but they also frustrate me because those are the utilities that you look at and you say, this is exactly what Apple should have done, and they just didn't do it. They just didn't bother.
Yeah.
I'll refer you back to my previous point, which is if you're going to do something, I mean, HomeKit in general is kind of like this. But like, if you're going to do something like this, you got to do it. I do wonder, several people brought up that new Home Alliance between Amazon and Google and Apple and everybody else. I do wonder if the Home app and all of that stuff is
slated for some major changes.
It's a low priority in a way because they're going to go to a standard, at which point
anybody can write functions. An app. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think Lex brought this up too, and several other people as well. And you mentioned it in your sum up of the HomeKit category in the report card was Homebridge and the fact that so much stuff works with Homebridge that doesn't work out of the box with HomeKit.
Yeah.
That you kind of feel like, why is Apple not doing this? Like, why is Apple not have a framework that works like Homebridge does and just seamlessly bridges it? Because it's clearly possible. I have so much stuff that I control through Homebridge that is not supported by HomeKit default. And it's just puzzling, right? Because it's like it's doable. They have done it. It's a thing that exists. Why aren't you doing this with your vaunted standard that connects everything in the home?
Well, and maybe it's
baffling.
That will be part of that standard, perhaps, is backward compatibility right?
Cannot see why they would not do that if they are in fact planning a major rebrand.
This is one of those things where I say, well, maybe the reason that it doesn't get so much attention is because they know that it's not going to last. And like, why would we put more work into the Home app and HomeKit on the Mac when we know that it's just going to go away? Although I would argue, I mean, at least having the fundamentals there, if it's important to Apple should still write an app and still support it, even though it's now a kind of open standard and there can be like 80 million different apps that do it. Like,
well,
you want
that's a frustration point too, because then you have all the people who are like, oh, but which app do I download? Yeah. This one does this and this one does that.
And you can't put those apps in Control Center, at least not yet, right? On iOS or the Mac, like it's locked out the platform owner has to do it. Apple has to do it. And so, I don't know. It's just, I was happy to write that. It was great to find those apps. They've been around for a while, and I didn't know that. I didn't realize they were there, and then I didn't realize how many of them there were. But when I was able to find one that like does exactly what I want, and even has a bunch of features that I didn't dare dream of, like automation, where I feel like, you know, if I wanted to set up, like for example, if I wanted to set up a thing where I press a key and it's get ready for podcast and it like does all these things and like and it dims the lights or whatever it does, right? Like it would work with that. I don't I don't have something like that, but if I did, it could do that. It actually, I was thinking about it, it actually means I could do something like, if I wanted to have a do not on the air light up sign or something outside my office.
I've been thinking the same thing.
It would do it, you know, you could have that be part of the workflow and it'd be like, boom, now that I'm recording, now that Audio Hijack is open, whatever, that light just goes on. You could do stuff like that with a tool like this, which is great. That's fun. That's what I want. That's exactly what I want. So that was a fun thing. We haven't talked about results. Apple had the most unsurprising record quarter of all time.
I mean, unsurprising, but also surprising, right? Like, I think the surprising part of it was, it's still kind of hard to wrap your head, to my mind, around $100 billion. That is it's just
$111
bananas amount of
point
money.
Four.
I know. And I'm rounding off $11 billion. Yeah. That is enough
to. Well, then let's say $30 billion in profit. It was 28.8, but let's round. So it's $110 billion in revenue and $30 billion in profit.
It's funny to my head that I'm rounding off $11 billion, which in and of itself is like several small companies.
Yeah,
but that's what I'm saying. It's hard to kind of grok it because it's such a crazy amount of money.
It's $1 million in revenue every minute. It's $1 billion in revenue every day.
Oh my God.
Right? It's a quarter, so it's 90 days, so it's more than a billion dollars a day in revenue for Apple.
Oh my God. That's just
In every region and up in every product category year over year. Although interestingly, the Mac went down slightly over. It is only the second biggest Mac quarter of all time after the previous quarter. And I saw John Gruber was speculating about how it is
back
because of supply constraint, which might be it. But I think also supply constraint with the M1 Max a little bit, and that may be. But I also think that there were a lot of people for back to school as part of the ongoing kind of like pandemic buying of computers and stuff who just they bought. In fiscal Q4.
They bought when they needed it the earlier quarter. Sure.
Yeah, June, July, August, or July, August, September instead of October, December.
The fact that they're up everywhere, and I mean the 21% jump for the Mac and the 41% jump for the iPad, which is also not the biggest jump ever for the iPad, right? But like,
no, it's not. It's the biggest biggest iPad quarter in. It's the seventh largest iPad quarter of all time, but it's the biggest iPad quarter in 6 years.
Yeah, I mean. What's interesting about that is the iPad struggled a lot in sort of the mid-2010s, right?
Yep.
It felt like Apple didn't know where that product was going, and it was getting squeezed from every side. And I think there are a lot of great points in the report card about this too, but like the how does the M1 Mac affect the future of the iPad? Like, what is that? When it brings so many of the benefits.
There were so many good comments there that were basically like, now that the iPad and the Mac essentially have exactly the same hardware, it really shows you that the iPad's limitations are in software, which we already knew.
Yep.
But like,
yep.
I think that's a fair cop to say that. To
totally.
Be like, 100%. Now you can really see it. Because like somebody said, the DTK for developers was literally an iPad Pro chip. And so it really lays bare the fact that the iPad's constraints have nothing to do with the power of its hardware. It's all limitations of iPad OS.
And it used to be, do you want the sort of multitasking power of a Mac, or do you want the lightweight and battery life of an iPad? Now it's like, well, you can kind of get that on the Mac too. But I think the point that the iPad went up so much still suggests that there is a huge value to it, especially in the environment that we're in right now, where people need more computing devices, I think, in a lot of cases, right? People who are now have kids at home or now are at home all the time when they used to have more stuff at the office now need to invest in more devices. I think that's one part of it. I think the iPad Air that came out this fall is incredibly compelling for the average user. It's a step up even over the, what are they on, eighth generation iPad, which is a very perfectly fine, capable device. But the iPad Air is like, as I think many people said, why buy an iPad Pro right now? And the answer is, there's probably not a lot of reason to at this very moment. Eventually, the iPad Pro, probably sooner rather than later, will get a refresh.
Yeah.
And then hopefully there will be more of a delineation there. But right now, the iPad Air is a, generally speaking, a much better buy for most people.
Yeah, and the iPad Pro is old. I mean, like turning on one GPU core, don't fool, and adding LiDAR, like don't fool me.
Right.
That was a
really meager update.
Yeah. The iPad Pro essentially hasn't been updated since 2018.
Right. And having the fact that the iPad Air works with the Magic Keyboard, mm-hmm. and like, you know, all that stuff. I think, again, it's a very compelling device.
That's why it was a good iPad year, is because that Magic Keyboard came out. Although even then, which I think is a great thing that Apple did, is that it works with the 2018 iPad Pro just as much as the 2020 model, which is great. But like, that is an amazing accessory, and adding cursor support was huge. And like, they're doing some great things. It was, I would argue, a great year for the iPad, even though the iPad Pro essentially treaded water. But it's very clear that the iPad Pro is next up. Like, they need that and the OS, right? It's going to be the same story that we've been talking about for a few years now. A bunch of us who are iPad focused, especially, it's like they gotta up their game. Splitting off iPad OS and saying it's different than iOS is great, because it allows them to make decisions that are different for the two platforms, which is great. But they need to deliver. They need to deliver on making the iPad platform more powerful.
Yeah, I agree with you that that had promise, but I mean, so far it has kind of been borne out largely the way I expected it to go, which was it got a big fanfare when it happened, and then it's kind of trickled off. Well, like, it really doesn't feel that different than the iPad updates we've had in the past.
I would say, if you look at it in the lens of an annual update, I would agree with you. But the two things that I would say, pro and con. Pro is they did that cursor update, right? They didn't wait that to be in iPad OS, but that's an iPad feature, and it was a big deal, and they did a great job with it. It's a beautiful feature. They really knocked it out of the park. Great job. The con here will be the fact that it also freed them up to rethink widgets in the home screen on the iPhone and just say, man, we're not doing that on the iPad. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, which to itself, left. And again, if that's the harbinger of some more in, like, thorough rethink,
it
coming
totally
to
is
the iPad.
Yeah.
And I think
and the more iPad like big space, rethink of the home screen that is like just for the iPad and not the sort of spaced out with a little sidebar thing that's there now, which I think ultimately is the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised either, because if you look back over the history of the iPad and software updates for the iPad, they tended to very much be on a two-year cycle. I think if you look back over the last several years, you will see kind of major, like the multitasking thing, there was like, they took a year off in between introducing it and then refining it. Like, there's a lot of cases with that in the iPad where it's like something comes out, the next year is kind of a light update for the iPad, and then the following year is like another big swing. And I think, to my mind, that makes sense, right? Like, it is the driving of the annual software updates makes it hard to kind of, in a development cycle, I think, probably spin out a new feature in like the, you know, 9 months or whatever you have between shipping and writing a new feature, right?
Somebody in the report card pointed out, I think quite rightly, that Apple is essentially moving away in some ways from the annual cycle, or at least in terms of the rollout. Like, and we've seen this for a few years now, but it keeps happening where Apple announces a bunch of stuff, but not all of it ships with a 0.0 release, right?
It dribbles out over the course of the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, and that's okay. Several people made the point, and I totally agree with this, several people made the point that macOS development, it feels like they could slow it down.
Yeah,
I think the problem with that idea is they want to keep it in sync with iOS. Like, everything, right? They re-architected iOS and macOS to be more alike so that they can share more subsystems, right? Because they had diverged after the iPhone came out. And a few years ago, and I think it culminating in Catalina, they kind of brought all those subsystems back together. And so you don't want to update iOS every year and have macOS kind of fall behind a step.
Right.
You want to keep those in line. You got the same processors and all that. That said, you know, you said, what version of macOS is this? I don't think it would be a problem for them to have the next version of macOS be
11.5
and give it a name, but like basically say, this is the half step. Come back in a year and we'll make another whole step, and just sort of send the message that they're trying to navigate this. But I think the realistic thing is Apple can try to spread out the features as much as it wants, but if it wants to do an iOS release every year, it's going to do a macOS release every year, a major milestone under the hood kind of thing, because they want to keep them in sync because of features, and also because of all the underlying technology, because of the chips that are coming out, all of that stuff. Like, the Mac and iOS are even more in sync than they used to be.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think the struggle would be like, is there a way to, I mean, even iOS is getting to a point where major overhauls every year are less necessary than they used to be. They're both, here's the thing. There's both stuff that's so big that feels like it needs to be addressed and isn't, probably because they're on the treadmill of having to release updates every year. And it's like, for example, I've complained a bunch about autocorrect, a system that I think is very, very broken. That's probably more than a year's worth of work to fix. And so part of me wonders, what if they just put them both on an every 2 year cycle where there is a 0.5 and then a major release every other year? I'm not sure that would be a terrible thing. I understand why Apple feels like it needs to have a marquee full number version out every year. But, you know, as people in the past who've lauded the wonders of Snow Leopard, the Snow Leopard diehards have pointed out, like, yep, sometimes you just need a release that feels like it fixes a lot of the problems that people have been dealing with.
And other than underlying technology, like deep underlying technology, Apple has shown, and Apple has been able to do this for years, but even recent Apple has shown, you can roll out a big feature update that is off cycle. You know, maybe it's something you planned for, but like in some ways, the annual cycle is about communicating new fundamental features and policy changes to developers, right? It's about putting a stake in the ground and say, when this release comes out, all these things are going to change and users are going to have to update and then there's going to be a change. Like, I get that, but that process could become uncoupled a little bit from, like, look at the cursor thing, right? Like, that cursor support thing, that's a huge feature. It's an enormous feature. And it was announced and shipped in March, basically, yeah, like mid-cycle. And it was fine. And Apple will often release new hardware that has new features. You know, the fall release is tied to the iPad or iPhone release, right? And so you get new iPhones and new OS features that are on the iPhone. Although even then, the features that are on the new iPhone hardware weren't announced in June because they're secret until they're announced. But like Mac stuff will come out in the middle of the year, and there'll be like a new Mac with a new piece of hardware in it, and it'll only run this new build of Mac OS that runs on it because previous versions didn't have that in there. So like Apple can do that stuff too. So I don't think it's an argument that you have to, you have to do it because you have to keep pushing the platform forward and you've got a new feature here and a new feature there. But I think the truth is they are doing a lot of this stuff, right? They do seem to be backing off in some ways, and letting features kind of scatter throughout the year, and I think that's good. I think that's really good. I would almost rather have them sort of every 3 or 4 months do a kind of milestone, yeah, update that's got some stuff in it, and then if WWDC becomes the time, I mean, we've said this a million times already, where they're really just laying out their roadmap for the next year and how, yeah, the fundamental changes will roll out and then feature changes will also roll out. That works for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think what's interesting potentially about this is also to tie it into something else that we dealt with this past year, which will almost certainly be a thing that we're dealing with this year. The virtual WWDC component, not having to gather everybody once a year for a big, huge announcement thing, also feels like maybe there's something there that, you know, if you felt like that was something anchoring you to the idea of we need to have big announcements because we're calling 5,000 developers and media every summer, you know, if you have maybe two events in 6 months apart, or you have, you know, that are smaller or something like that, or you have some more focused tracks for specific products or something. I don't know. There's a lot of different ways you can do this. Just because this is the way you've been doing it for the last however many years doesn't mean you shouldn't try to see if there are other things that help. And the fact that we're definitely not going to have 5,000 people at a convention center, yep, this year should free you up to think differently about how you might handle that.
Also, Tim Cook called Facebook evil today.
And Mark Zuckerberg called Apple its big evil competitor, not evil, but they basically said they're screwing with us.
Yeah.
So that war is about to get hot.
Oh yeah, it's heating up. I've seen, I don't want to talk a lot about the Tim Cook thing, but I will say that a lot of people responded to that by saying, well, Apple, of course Apple would say this. It's in their own self-interest because their business model works with privacy. And it's like, okay, it's true. And you and I have both talked about this and we've written about it. It is true that Apple can run its business the way it wants to with privacy at the center. So it is... it is coming from a position of self-interest to a certain extent, or at least it's an easier path for them to walk. I don't see how that matters.
Yeah.
Because it's also the right thing to do. And Apple has, and it doesn't give them enough credit for constructing their business around practices that are less evil. Right?
Right. I mean,
but saying, well, like, I didn't build a business around something evil. And so when I say I'm against evil, it doesn't matter because the only people who can really speak out against evil are people who are evil, I guess. I mean, it doesn't, well, I think it's a dumb argument to say that just because Apple's business model is aligned with this, that they shouldn't talk about it. Because I think they believe it. It is not just a self-serving statement. And let's be honest, Apple could make a lot of money by being more evil. And there are places where it refrains. Now, it also does still get paid billions of dollars by Google to make Google the default search engine in Safari. And if it wanted to, it could probably invest in a replacement that was more privacy-focused, and it doesn't do that. There's more they could do, but I think it goes without saying that if Apple had wanted to build up their services business, for example, with a lot of privacy-questionable things, they could have chosen that, but they've chosen not to. And somebody's got to speak out with clout, has got to speak out about this. And if it's not the companies that are going to never want to stop being evil, then it's got to be the companies who don't want to be evil. And that's just how it is. And I'm throwing around the word evil, but like, read Tim Cook's remarks. Tim Cook basically lays at the foot of Facebook and at the foot of YouTube, political polarization around the world, including in the United States, violence around the world, including in the United States. Like he lays it, and of course, violations of privacy. And he doesn't name names, but we all know who he's talking about. And, you know, that's why I know it sounds glib, but I'm being serious. He is saying what they're doing is evil. It's detrimental to society. And the only option we have is to reform them. That's it.
Yeah, it's not quite a situation of being, you know, a stopped clock being right twice a day. It's more like, you know, Apple always had its clock, and every once in a while things come around and align with the way that it does things, which I don't want to, again, like you, I don't want to argue that it's not doing things that are good and doesn't believe those things are good. But it also has the benefit of, unlike Facebook or Google, it is, you know, more than 40-year-old company. It came out, you know, it was building stuff and had a business model long before these issues became nearly as prevalent as they are today. And you're totally right that it could have pivoted at some point and decided, like, this is the way to do business. But I think in some ways its approach and its ethos had been more crystallized by the time that this stuff became profitable and became an avenue or a business model that you could pursue, that it was able, because it didn't rely on that, to say, we can focus on privacy and we will focus on privacy. And then that became, I think, more of a virtuous cycle where the fact that they realized, you know, hey, we can and should focus on that became, well, this is a big differentiator for us, and we feel it's the right thing to do. We do think it's aligned with the right values. So I think there's some interplay there. I don't want to totally, you know, obviously Google for a long time had "Don't be evil" as its motto.
I know, right?
Something that people took a lot of issue with, and rightfully so in recent years. But I think that Apple has been free to be able to make that choice, and because they have made that choice, that has began to pay dividends for them in the sense of, it is a very valuable point. And I think some of it was prescience too, right? Like, there was that quote floating around from Steve Jobs from, I don't know, was it like 10 years ago or something?
Yeah, it's from the D conference.
Right, yeah, where he said, we think, you know, basically you should tell people every time that you are doing something. And like, That's great. Let's not argue that Steve Jobs was a altruistic businessman, because clearly not the case. No, but it doesn't mean you can't be aligned sometimes with the right thing to do, and it's good for you. It makes money.
And I think the truth is that Apple's DNA here comes from the fact that they're a product company and that their business has always been selling products to customers.
That's what I'm saying. 40 plus years of that, then they didn't need
Whereas Google and advertising, Facebook and all of that, like they launched websites and got funding and then figured out how to make money, and it was like the oxygen for them to survive. And the ways that they figured out to make money, some of them at least were, or make more money, were what we would say now are, if not unethical or evil, like invasive to privacy and perhaps corrosive to society. But they did it because they needed to survive. And and Cook said, like, he says, I'm a CEO of a big business. I don't want to talk about, like, yay, regulation. But he said there are certain things that seem like the only way, like GDPR, like the only way that behavior will change and that the behavior of companies will be reformed is with regulation. And when you look at the fact that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg controls Facebook, he can't be told what to do by anybody except governments. Right. I mean,
we just mentioned that Apple made $111 billion this quarter. Who has the clout?
Exactly.
When Apple does do something wrong, who has the clout to tell them that?
So what I'm saying is anybody, this goes back to like when I was talking to Mike on Upgrade a while ago about like rumors, and it's like always consider the source, like who has something to gain from having that information get out. It's just a good thing to
do.
It's part of like media literacy. So when Tim Cook says something like this, consider the source. You should consider the source. And you should consider that, yes, indeed, Apple has built its business around not doing this. And we could argue chicken and egg, or cart and horse. I think primarily Apple has built its business around this for, I mean, it's both. It's historical reasons, like we said, and it's also, I think, that they want to believe, they want to treat their customers right, and they think the best customer relationship is you pay us and we give you stuff, and not we give it to you for free and then we find ways to make money off of your back. And so fundamentally, that's different. So you should know that. You should be aware that when Tim Cook says something like this, it's easy for him to say it because his company is making huge amounts of money without
but it doesn't make any of those things.
But that's exactly right. Yeah. You cannot take the next leap, which is just because he can say it because his business is not involved here does not mean that he's not right by saying it. It does not invalidate his stand. And like I would argue, I think there's money to be made. There is more money to be made for Apple being evil and making deals with these companies and selling out its customers. And Apple has said, no, that's not the business we're in. And Apple's got lots of issues, and a lot of them are detailed in the social environmental portion of the report card. There are lots of things that Apple, nobody is saying Apple is saintly and all of that. But on this issue, I think Apple is absolutely right. And I'm glad there's a company that is not so indebted to the cash flow from selling out their customers that they can say this is wrong.
Yeah, I think what we're hinting at a little bit there is like essentially the line between being skeptical and being cynical, right? You can be skeptical of something and think, well, let me examine that. Let me think about that and come to a conclusion, as opposed to being cynical, which is just they're all evil. They're all big companies. They're all evil. Nothing they say can be trusted. Therefore, I will distrust everything that they do say. You know, sometimes there are cases where there are things that are right. And even once you've considered the source, you think, well, yeah, they make a lot of money off that. But like, do I want all my personal information harvested by all these companies just so I can get social networking for free? Is that what I want? Is that a thing that's good? Like, yeah, that's the line you got to think about. So I think we're headed for a showdown there, not just between Facebook and Apple, but I think privacy regulations, especially with the current composition of the administration and our government, I think is something that's gonna be cropping up in the next few years, and that we're gonna start to see, like, yeah, maybe we do need some serious regulations around that, because again, like we said, these companies are so big, they are bigger than many countries, right? They are bigger than many countries in the world in the amount of money that they bring in some cases a lot. So who gets to boss them around? Someone has to, right? Like the invisible hand of the marketplace no, that's not actually how this works.
Well, and
just ask GameStop.
Societies need to stand up and say, okay, I know we want to let the free market run and we want to let businesses run, but we have a bunch of businesses now that are destroying the society. And as a society,
there's limits. There's limits to everything.
Well, yeah,
you know, we talked
pollution,
about this,
like as a society,
before,
we've
too, right?
Like your factories can't belch things that like acid into the sky that cause people to die or be poisoned. As a society, we've decided you can't do that business. Like societies get to make those decisions. Do they make them wisely all the time? Of course
no.
They don't. Do they make them with lots of special interests in mind that make them defanged kind of solutions? Yes, of course. But don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Societies do need to say, oh, it turns out that this completely unfettered social media and privacy brokering and all of these other things, it turns out, have deleterious effects for our society. Well, who will do something about it? Guess what? It's you.
Is there anything in life where it's, you know, fantastic and awesome and always great and never has any downside, right? Like
ice cream. Ice cream is the only thing.
That's right. There's no downside to ice cream. I was thinking maybe Ted Lasso, but that was all I had. Was
okay.
maybe there's no downside to Ted Lasso.
People
but
are going to read the report card and be like,
yeah,
oh, right. Ted Lasso. They keep talking about Ted Lasso. I took out so many more references to Ted Lasso. Everybody mentioned Ted Lasso.
Yeah. Well,
it is one
of the few things that's all good. But yes, in every other case, there are limits on things because we've decided unlimited things of that type, not so great.
All right, well, it's the hope that kills you. Be a goldfish.
Be curious, Jason.
Be a goldfish.
Be a curious goldfish.
Thanks to everybody out there for listening. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.